Hello and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com, also posted at pyville.net and kirksvilletoday.com. Today we're going to resume with The Crucifixion of Russian, a new English translation of Solzhenitsyn's 200 Years Together, A History of the Russians and the Jews by Columbus Falco, his translation of it. We're going to start volume two. This work is divided into two volumes. I don't know if anything's left out. We're going to see. I have not read this part yet. But volume two, The Jews and the Soviet Union. So before now, we've heard about the last few hundred years of Jews and attempts to turn them into farmers, attempts to integrate them into public school and assimilate them, and how it sort of looked like it was working. Then it failed utterly, and the farmers and the rest, they just took over the high points and started dominating all the schools before the turn of the century. And now we're going to hear about Jews in the Soviet Union. He's kind of been going decade by decade from the 1840s up to the 1880s, so I don't know how much he's going to focus on 1900 to 1917, but we'll see. Chapter XIII, 13. So this is why it feels like something has been left out, because we had four or five chapters in the first volume, so I don't know. But anyway, Volume 2, The Jews and the Soviet Union, Chapter 13, The February Revolution. This is recording number 9. And it's going to be about 20 pages. We'll divide this chapter into two, and the next one will be longer. Flipping on to 182. The 123-year-old history of unequal citizenship of the Jewish people in Russia from the act of Catherine the Great of 1791 ended with the 1917 February Revolution. Editor's note. Solzhenitsyn refers to the first Russian Revolution that overthrew the Tsar, not the subsequent Bolshevik Revolution in October of that same year. There were two revolutions. It bears looking into the atmosphere of those February days. What was the state of society by the moment of emancipation? There were no newspapers during the first week of the revolutionary events in Petrograd, and then they began trumpeting, not looking for ways to rebuild the state, but vying with each other and denouncing all of the things of the past. In an unprecedented gesture, the newspaper of the Constitutional Democrats, the Kadets, K-A-D-E-T-S, REC, REC announced that from now on, quote, all Russian life must be rebuilt from the roots. A thousand-year life. Why all of a sudden from the roots? And the stock market news announced a program of action. Yank, yank, all these weed roots out. No need to worry that there might be some useful plants among them. It's better to weed them all, even at the price of unavoidable innocent victims. Was this really March 1917 or March 1937? The new Minister of Foreign Affairs, Milyukov, bowed and scraped, quote, up to now, we blushed in front of our allies because of our government. Russia was a dead weight for our allies. Rarely in those beginning days was it possible to hear reasonable suggestions about rebuilding Russia. The streets of Petrograd were in chaos. The police were non-functional, and all over the city there was continuous disorderly gunfire. But everything poured into a general rejoicing. Though for every concrete question there was a mess of thoughts and opinions, a cacophony of debating pens, all the press and society agreed on one thing, the immediate legislative enactment of Jewish equality. All the press and society agreed on that. Fyodor Sologub eloquently wrote in the Birchevia Vidomosti, quote, the most essential beginning of the civil freedom, without which our land cannot be blessed, the people cannot be righteous, national achievements would not be sanctified, is the repeal of all religious and racial restrictions. Let the Jews run wild in the name of equality. The liberation of the Jews. The equality of the Jews advanced very quickly. The 1st of March, old calendar style, one day before the abdication, a few hours before the infamous Order No. 1, which pushed the army to collapse, V. Maklakov and M. Adjimov, two commissars of the Duma Committee, delegated to the Ministry of Justice, two commissars of the Duma Committee delegated to the Ministry of Justice had issued an internal Ministry of Justice directive ordering to enlist all Jewish assistants to attorneys at law into the Guild of Judicial Attorneys. Already by the 3rd of March, the chairman of the State Duma, M. Rodzianko, and the prime minister of the provisional government, Prince G. Lvov, signed a declaration which stated that one of the main goals of the new government is a, quote, repeal of all restrictions based upon religion, nationality, and social class. Then, on the 4th of March, the defense minister Guchkov proposed to open a path for the Jews to become military officers, and the minister of education, Manuelov, proposed to repeal the percentage quotas on the Jews, the restrictions. Both proposals were accepted without obstacles. On the 6th of March, the minister of trade and manufacturing, Konovalov, started to eliminate national restrictions. Incorporative legislation, that is, a repeal of the law forbidding purchase of land by companies with Jewish executives. These measures were quickly put into practice. By the 8th of March, 1917, in Moscow, 110 Jewish, quote, assistants were raised to the status of attorneys at law. By March 9th in Petrograd, 124 such Jews. By the 8th of March in Odessa, 60. On the 9th of March, the city Duma of Kiev, not waiting for the upcoming elections, included in its body five Jews with voting power. And here, on March 20th, the provisional government made a resolution prepared by the Minister of Justice, A. Kerensky, with the participation of members of the Political Bureau of Jewish Deputies in the 4th State Duma, legislated an act published on March 22nd that repealed all restrictions on the rights of Russian citizens, regardless of religious creed, dogma, or nationality. This was, in essence, the first broad legislative act of the provisional government. At the request of the Political Bureaus of Jewish Deputies, the Jews were not specifically mentioned in the resolution. But in order to, quote, repeal all the restrictions on Jews in all of our laws, in order to uproot completely the inequality of Jews, G.B. Sliosberg recalls, quote, it was necessary to make a complete list of all the restrictions, and the collation of the list of laws to be repealed required great thoroughness and experience. This task was undertaken by Sliosberg and L.M. Bramson. The Jewish Encyclopedia says, quote, the act listed the statutes of Russian law that were being abolished by the act. Almost all those statutes, there were nearly 150, contained some or other anti-Jewish restrictions. Subject to repeal were, in part, all proscriptions connected to the Pale of Settlement. Thereby, its factual liquidation in 1915 was legally validated. So they got rid of the Pale of Settlement. They got rid of 150 laws that were restricting Jews in any way to give them full run of Russian society. And you see what happened afterwards. The restrictions were removed layer by layer. Travel, habitation, where you can go, where you can live, what educational institutions you can get into, participation in local self-government, the right to acquire property anywhere in Russia, participation in government contracts from stock exchanges, hiring servants, workers, and stewards of a different religion, the right to occupy high positions in the government and military service, guardianship and trusteeship. Recalling a cancellation of an agreement with the United States, they repealed similar restrictions on, quote, foreigners who are not at war with the Russian government, unquote, mainly in reference to Jews coming from the United States. The promulgation of the act inspired many emotional speeches. Deputy Friedman of the State Duma asserted, quote, for the past 35 years, the Jews have been subjected to oppression and humiliation, unheard of and unprecedented, even in the history of our long-suffering people. Standard Jewish bilge. All of it was the result of state-sponsored anti-Semitism. Attorney O.O. Grusenberg stated, quote, if the pre-revolution Russian government was a vast and monstrous prison, then its most stinking, terrible cell, its torture chamber, was carted away for us, the 6 million Jewish people. And for the first time, the Jewish child learned about this usurious term, interest, in the state school. Like hard labor camp prisoners on their way to camp, All Jews were chained together as despised aliens. The drops of blood of our fathers and mothers, the drops of blood of our sisters and brothers, fell on our souls, there igniting and enlivening the unextinguishable revolutionary fire. Rosa Georgievna, the wife of Vinaver, recalls, quote, "The events of the March 1917 revolution coincided with the Jewish Passover. It looked like this was a second escape from Egypt. Such a long, long path of suffering and struggle has passed, and how quickly everything had happened. A large Jewish meeting was called, at which Milyukov spoke. Quote, "At last, a shameful spot has been washed away from Russia, which can now bravely step into the ranks of civilized nations." Right before they start killing everybody. That's what loosing Jews mean. The freer Jews are, the more constrained Aryans are, the more they get slaughtered. And they defame them and set them up, prepare a pyre to kill them. Excuse me. And again, the way to deal with Jews is to exterminate them, not to mess around with them and pass restrictions and the rest of this garbage. They had 10 commissions trying to do this and that. None of it worked. The way to do it is to get rid of them. Vinaver proposed to the gathering to build, quote, "a large Jewish public house in Petrograd in memory of the meeting, which will be called the House of Freedom." Three members of the State Duma, M. Bomash, E. Gurevich, and N. Friedman, published an open letter to the Jewish people that, quote, "that now, quote, our military misfortunes could deal grave damage to the still infirm free Russia. Free Jewish warriors will draw new strength for the ongoing struggle with the tenfold energy extending the great feat of arms." And here was the natural plan. Quote, "The Jewish people should quickly reorganize their society. The long obsolete forms of our communal life must be renewed on the free democratic principles." So now they're getting into mainstream society and taking it over. The author-journalist David Eisman responded to the act with an outcry, quote, "Our motherland, our fatherland, they are in trouble. With all our hearts, we will defend our land. Not since the defense of the temple has there been such a sacred feat of arms." Close quote. Yet from the memoirs of Sliosberg, quote, "the great fortune to have lived to see the day of the Declaration of Emancipation of Jews in Russia and the elimination of our lack of rights, everything I have fought for with all my strength over the course of 3 decades, did not fill me with the joy as it should have done, because the collapse had begun right away." 7 years later, one Jewish author expressed doubts too. Quote, "Did that formal legislative act really change the situation in the country where all legal norms were precipitously losing their power?" We answer, says Solzhenitsyn, "in hindsight, from great distance, one should not downplay the significance of what was achieved. Then the act suddenly and dramatically improved the situation of the Jews. As for the rest of the country, falling with all its peoples into an abyss, that was the unpredictable way of the history." I don't know what that means. Seems pretty clear. You liberate the Jews, you enslave yourself. "The first acts of Jewish retaliation," that's page 187, turning on or sliding across to. The first acts of Jewish retaliation. "The most abrupt and notable change occurred in the judiciary. If earlier the Batyushin's Commission on Bribery investigated the business of the obvious crook, D. Rubinstein, now the situation became reversed. The case against Rubinstein was dropped, and Rubinstein paid a visit to the Extraordinary Investigatory Commission in the Winter Palace and successfully demanded prosecution of the Batyushin's Commission itself. Indeed, in March 1917, they arrested General Batyushin, Colonel Rezanov, and other investigators. The investigation of activities of that commission began in April, and, as it turned out, the extortion of bribes from the bankers and sugar factory owners by them was apparently significant. Then the safes of Volga Kama, Siberian, and Junker banks, previously sealed up by Batyushin, were unsealed and all the documents returned to the banks. Simanovich and Manus were not so lucky. When Simanovich was arrested as secretary to Rasputin, he offered 15,000 rubles to the prison convoy guards if they would let him make a phone call, yet the request was, of course, turned down. As for Manus, suspected of being involved in shady dealings with the German agent Kolishko, he battled the counterintelligence agents who came for him by shooting through his apartment's door. After his arrest, he fled the country. The situation in the Extraordinary Investigatory Commission of the provincial government can be manifestly traced by records of interrogations in late March. Protopopov was asked how he came to be appointed to the Ministry of Internal Affairs, and in response, he mentioned the directive issued by him. The residence rights of the Jews were significantly expanded in Moscow. Asked about the priorities of his ministry, he first recalled the foodstuffs affair, and after then the progressive issue, the Jewish question. The director of the Department of Police, A.T. Vasilyev, didn't miss an opportunity to inform the interrogators that he helped defend the sugar factory owners, who were Jews. Quote, Grunzenberg called me in the morning in my apartment and thanked me for my cooperation. Rosenberg visited me to thank me for my efforts on his behalf. In this way, the accused tried to get some leniency for themselves. A notable aspect of the weeks of March was an energetic pursuit of known or suspected Judeophobes. The first one arrested on February 27th was the Minister of Justice, Sheglovitov. He was accused of personally giving the order to unjustly pursue the 1911 case against Mendel Bilis. I believe that was one of the Jews who was accused of sacrificing a Christian child. And he did it, too. In subsequent days, Bilis's accusers, the prosecutor Vipper and Senator Chaplinsky, were also arrested. However, they were not charged with anything specific. Yeah, because the charge is being anti-Jew. And in May 1917, Vipper was merely dismissed from his position as the chief prosecutor of the criminal department of the Senate. His fate was sealed later by the Bolsheviks. The court investigator, Mashkevich, was ordered to resign, for during the Bilis trial, he had sanctioned not only expert witness testimony against the argument on the ritual murder, but he also allowed a second expert testimony arguing for the case of such murder. The Minister of Justice, Kerensky, requested transfer of all materials of the Bilis case from the Kiev Regional Court, planning a loud retrial, but during the stormy course of 1917, that didn't happen. The chairman of the Union of the Russian People, Dmitry Dubrovin, was arrested and his archive was seized. The publishers of the far-right newspaper Glinka Yanchevsky and Polu Boyarinova were arrested too. The bookstores of the Monarchist Union were simply burned down. And Jews have that tendency to attack and burn anyone who criticizes them. They are a people of deplatforming. They don't believe anyone should be allowed to criticize them ever. That's why you can't give them any freedom at all. They can't be allowed in white lands. It's just, they're a different type. For 2 weeks, they hunted for the fugitive, quote, anti-Semites, unquote, N. Markov and Zamislavsky, doing nightly searches for 2 weeks in St. Petersburg, Kiev, and Kursk. Zamislavsky was hunted for his participation in the case against Bilis, and Markov, obviously, for his speeches in the State Duma. At the same time, they didn't touch Purishkevich, one assumes because of his revolutionary speeches in the Duma and his participation in the murder of Rasputin. An ugly rumor arose that Stolypin took part in the murder of Iolos, and in Kremenchuk, a street that had previously been named after Stolypin was renamed after Iolos, I-O-L-L-O-S. Over all of Russia, there were hundreds of arrests, either because of the Gentile victims' former positions or even because of their former attitudes. It should be noted that the announcement of Jewish equality did not cause a single pogrom. It is worth noticing not only for the comparison to 1905, but also because all through March and April, all major newspapers were constantly reporting the preparation of pogroms and that somewhere the pogroms had already supposedly begun. Rumor started on March 5th that somewhere either in Kiev or Poltava province, Jewish pogroms were brewing, and someone in Petrograd put up a handwritten anti-Jewish flyer. As a result, the Executive Committee of Soviet Workers and Soldiers deputies formed a special visiting commission led by Rafis Alexandrovich and Sukhanov. Their task was to delegate commissars to various towns, with the first priority to go into the regions where the Black Hundreds, the servants of the old regime, were allegedly trying to sow ethnic antagonism among the population. In the newspaper Izvestia of the Soviet Workers and Soldiers Deputies, there was an article entitled Incitement to Pogrom. Quote, "It would be a huge mistake, tantamount to a crime, to close our eyes to a new attempt of the overthrown dynasty, because it is them, the monarchists, who organized the trouble. In Kiev and Poltava provinces, among the underdeveloped, backward classes of the population, at this moment there is incitement against Jews. Jews are blamed for the defeats of our army, for the revolutionary movement in Russia, and for the fall of the monarchy. It's an old trick, but all the more dangerous because of its timing. It is necessary to quickly take decisive measures against the pogrom instigators." After this, the commander of the Kiev military district, General Khodorovich, issued an order. All military units were to be on high alert and be ready to prevent possible anti-Jewish riots. So you see how quickly they take power and start immediately harassing and doing violence against people they don't like, anyone who's aware of what they actually do. Long after this, but still in April, in various newspapers, every 2 or 3 days, they published rumors of preparations for Jewish pogroms, or at the very least about moving piles of, quote, pogrom literature, unquote, by railroad. Yet the most stubborn rumors circulated about a coming pogrom in Kishinev that was to happen at the end of March, right between the Jewish and Russian Orthodox Passovers, as happened in 1903. And this is why I think there must be something missing here. They've left out the 20 years from basically 1890 to the revolution, more or less. And there were many more such alarming press reports. One even said that the police in Mogilev were preparing a pogrom near the headquarters of Supreme High Command. Not one of these proved true, so they're circulating a bunch of lies, as they always do. One need only get acquainted with the facts of those months to immerse oneself in the whole, quote, February atmosphere of the defeated right and the triumphant left, of the stupor and confusion of the common folk, to dismiss outright any realistic possibility of anti-Jewish pogroms. But how could ordinary Jewish residents of Kiev or Odessa forget those horrible days 12 years before? Their apprehension, their wary caution to any motion in that direction was absolutely understandable. The well-informed newspapers were a different story. The alarms raised by the newspapers, by enlightened leaders of the liberal camp and half-baked socialist intellectuals, one cannot call this anything except political provocation. Provocation, however, that fortunately didn't work. One actual episode occurred at the Bessarabian Bazaar in Kiev on April 28th. A girl stole a piece of ribbon in a Jewish shop and ran away. The store clerk caught up to her and began to beat her. A crowd rushed to lynch the clerk and the store owner, but the police defended them. In another incident in the Rogachevsky district, people angered by exorbitant prices smashed the stores, including Jewish ones. Where and by whom was the Jewish emancipation met with hostility? Those were our legendary revolutionary Finland and our, quote, powerful ally, Romania. In Finland, as we learned in Chapter 10 from Jabotinsky, so a bunch has been left out here. So if I can find it, I will have to integrate it later. So we're on Chapter 13 after doing like Chapter 5. It's kind of irritating because this, God knows, this book is thick enough. It's 700 pages. In Finland, as we learned in Chapter 10 from Jabotinsky, the Jews were forbidden to reside permanently, and since 1858, only descendants of Jewish soldiers who served there in Finland during the Crimean War were allowed to settle. The passport law of 1862 confirmed that Jews were forbidden entry into Finland, although temporary habitation was permitted at the discretion of a local governor. Jews could not become Finnish citizens. In order to get married, a Jew had to go to Russia. The rights of the Jews to testify in Finnish courts were restricted. Several attempts to mitigate the restriction of the civil rights of the Jews in Finland were not successful, and now, with the advent of Jewish equal rights in Russia, Finland, not having yet announced its complete independence from Russia, did not legislate Jewish equality. Moreover, they were deporting Jews who had illegally moved to Finland, and not in a day, but in an hour, on the next train out. One such case on March 16 caused quite a splash in the Russian press. But Finland was always extolled for helping the revolutionaries, and liberals and socialists stopped short of criticizing her. Only the Boon sent a wire to very influential Finnish socialists, reprimanding them that this, quote, medieval, unquote, law was still not repealed. The Boon, quote, the part of the Jewish proletariat, expresses strong certainty that you will take out that shameful stain from free Finland, unquote. However, in this certainty, the Boon was mistaken. And a huge alarm was raised in the post-February press about a persecution of Jews in Romania. They wrote that in Jassy, J-A-S-S-Y, it was even forbidden to speak Yiddish at public meetings. The all-Russian Zionist Student Congress, Gekover, proposed, quote, to passionately protest this civil inequality of Jews in Romania and Finland, which is humiliating to the world Jewry and demeaning to worldwide democracy, unquote. At that time, Romania was weakened by major military defeats. So the Prime Minister, Bratianu, was making excuses in Petrograd in April, saying that, quote, most of the Jews in Romania migrated there from Russia, and in particular, that prompted Romanian government to limit soon the political rights of the Jews. He promised equality soon. However, in May we read, quote, in fact, nothing is happening in that direction. In May, the Romanian communist Rakovsky reported that, quote, the situation of the Jews in Romania is unbearable. The Jews were blamed for the military defeat of the country. They were accused of fraternizing with Germans in the occupied parts of the country. If the Romanian government was not afraid to anger their allies in the Entente, then one would fear for the very lives of the Jews. The worldwide response among the allies of the February Revolution was expressed in a tone of deep satisfaction and even ecstasy among many, but in this response there was also a short-sighted calculation that now Russia will become invincible in war. In Great Britain and the USA, there were large meetings in support of the revolution and the rights of the Jews. I wrote about some of these responses in March 1917 in chapters 510 and 621, says Solzhenitsyn, in March 1917, his book. From America, they offered to send a copy of the Statue of Liberty to Russia, yet as the situation in Russia continued to deteriorate, they never got around to the statue. On March 9th, in the House of Commons of the British Parliament, the Minister of Foreign Affairs was asked a question about the situation of Jews in Russia. Does he plan to consult with the Russian government regarding guarantees to the Russian Jews for the future and reparations for the past? The answer showed the full trust that the British government had for the new Russian government. From Paris, the president of the International Jewish Union congratulated Russian Prime Minister Prince Lvov, L-V-O-V, and Lvov answered, quote, from today onward, liberated Russia will be able to respect the faith and customs of all of its peoples, forever bound by a common religion of love of their homeland, close quote. The newspapers Birtsevka, Rec, and many others reported on the sympathies of Jacob Schiff, a well-known leader of North American circles hostile to Russia. He wrote, quote, I was always the enemy of Russian absolutism, which mercilessly persecuted my co-religionists. Now let me congratulate the Russian people for this great act which they committed so perfectly. And now he, quote, invites the new Russia to conduct broad credit operations in America, Schiff the banker who funded communism. New York banker, New York Jew, one of the most prominent and powerful Jews in America, certainly in the top five. Indeed, at the time, he provided substantial credit to the Kerensky government. That's the first revolution before the Bolshevik later that year, February and October. Alexander Kerensky, who ended up at Stanford, of all places. Later, in emigration, the exiled Russian right-wing press published investigative reports attempting to show that Schiff actively financed the revolution itself. Perhaps Schiff shared the short-sighted Western hope that the liberal revolution in Russia would strengthen Russia in the war. Still, the known and public acts of Schiff, who had always been hostile to Russian absolutism, had even greater effect than any possible secret assistance to such a revolution. The February Revolution itself often consciously appealed for support to Jews, an entire nation enslaved. Eyewitness testimonies that Russian Jews were very ecstatic about the February Revolution are rife. Yet there are counter-witnesses too, such as Gregory Aronson, who formed and led the Soviet Workers' Deputies of Vitebsk, which later had as a member Y.V. Tarle, T-A-R-L-E, a future historian. He wrote that on the very first day when news of the revolution reached Vitebsk, the newly formed Security Council met in the city Duma, and immediately afterwards, Aronson was invited to a meeting of representatives of the Jewish community, clearly not rank and file, but leaders. Quote, apparently there was a need to consult with me as a representative of the new dawning era, what to do further. I felt alienation from these people, from the circle of their interest, and from the tense atmosphere which was at the meeting. I had a sense that this society belonged mostly to the old world, which was retreating into the past. We were not able to eliminate a certain mutual chill that had come from somewhere. The faces of the people I was working with displayed no uplift or faith. At times it appeared that these selfless social activists perceived themselves as elements of the old order. That is a precise witness account. Such bewilderment, caution, and wavering predominated among religiously conservative Jews, one assumes, not only in Vitebsk. The sensible old Jewry, carrying a sense of many centuries of experience of hard ordeals, was apparently shocked by the sudden overthrow of the monarchy and had serious misgivings. Yet, in the spirit of the 20th century, the dynamic masses of every nation, including Jews, were already secular, not chained to traditions, and very eager to build, quote, the happy new world, unquote. The Jewish Encyclopedia notes, quote, a sharp intensification of the political activity of Jewry, noticeable even against a background of stormy social uplift that gripped Russia after February 1917. Myself, having worked for many years on the, quote, February press and memoirs of the contemporaries of the February, could not fail to notice this, quote, sharp strengthening, this gusting, says Solzhenitsyn. In those materials, from the most varied witnesses and participants of those events, there are so many Jewish names, and the Jewish theme is very loud and persistent. From the memories of Rodzienko, from the town governor Balk, from General Globachyov, and many others, from the first days of the revolution in the depths of the Tavrichevsky Palace, the numbers of Jews jumped out at me, among the members of the commandant's office, the interrogation commissions, the pamphlet merchants, and so on. So Solzhenitsyn says that Jews were very prominent, I guess, with and around the Kerensky Revolution in early 1917. V.D. Nabokov, who is well disposed towards Jews, wrote that on March 2nd, at the entrance to the Tavrichevsky mini park in front of the Duma building, there was an unbelievable crush of people and shouting. At the entrance of the gate, some young Jewish-looking men were questioning the bypassers. According to Balk, the crowd that went on the rampage at the Astoria, an elite hotel in St. Petersburg, on the night of February 28th, consisted of armed soldiers, sailors, and Jews. I would indulge some emigrant irritability here, as they used to say, well, that's all the Jews. Yet the same was witnessed by another neutral observer, the Methodist pastor Dr. Simons, an American who had already been in Petrograd for 10 years and knew it well. As we flip on to 196, he was debriefed by a commission of the American Senate in 1919. Quote, soon after the March Revolution of 1917, everywhere in Petrograd you could see groups of Jews standing on benches, soapboxes, and such, making speeches. There had been restrictions on the rights of Jews to live in Petrograd, but after the revolution they came in droves, and the majority of agitators were Jews. They were apostate Jews. That's the lie that the conservatives love to circulate, because a Jew is a race, it's not a religion. It doesn't matter what they think about Moses or any of that garbage. A certain, quote, student Hanok, H-A-N-O-K-H, came to Kronstadt a few days before a planned massacre of 60 officers who were named on a hit list. He became the founder and chairman of the Kronstadt's Committee of the Revolutionary Movement. The order of the committee was to arrest and try each and all officers. Somebody had carefully prepared and disseminated false information, triggering massacres first in Kronstadt, then in Sveaborg. It was because of the uncertainty of the situation when every fabrication was taken for a hard fact. The baton of the bloody Kronstadt affair was carried by the dropout psychoneurologist Dr. Rochal, R-O-S-H-A-L. Later, after the October coup, S.G. Rochal was appointed as the commandant of the Kachina, and from November he was the commissar on the whole Romanian front, where he was killed upon arrival. A certain Solomon and a Kaplan spoke on behalf of the newly formed revolutionary militia of the Vasilyevsky Island. In the future, the latter would become the bloody henchman of Zinoviev. The Petrograd Bar created a special, quote, commission for the examination of the justice of imprisoning persons arrested during the time of the revolution, unquote. Thousands were arrested during this time in Petrograd. That is, to virtually decide their fate without due process and that of all the former gendarmes and police. This commission was headed by the barrister Goldstein. Yet the unique story of the petty officer Timofey Kirpichnikov, K-I-R-P-I-C-H-Nikov, who triggered the street revolution, was written in March 1917 and preserved for us by the Jew Jacob Markovich Fishman, a curious historical figure. I gratefully relied on this story in The Red Wheel, says Solzhenitsyn. The Jewish Encyclopedia concludes, quote, Jews, for the first time in Russian history, had occupied posts in the central and regional administrations. On the very heights, in the executive committee of the Soviet of Workers and Soldiers deputies, invisibly ruling the country in those months, two leaders distinguished themselves, Nakhamkis Steklov and Gumer Sukhanov. On the night of March the 1st to March 2nd, they dictated to the complacently blind provisional government a program which preemptively destroyed its power for the entire period of its existence. Reflective contemporary G.A. Landau thus explains the active participation of Jews in the revolution. The misfortune of Russia and the misfortune of the Russian Jewry is that the results of the first revolution, this is the Kerensky February Revolution in 1905, were still not processed, not transformed, and not the first one in 17, but the early one in 1905, were still not processed, not transformed into a new social fabric. No new generation was born. When a great and backbreaking war broke out, and when the hour of disintegration came, it came back upon the generation that, from the very beginning, was a kind of exhausted remnant of the previous revolution. It found the inertia of depleted spirituality, lacking an organic connection to the situation, and chained by spiritual stagnation to the 10 years ago bygone period. And so the organic revolutionism of the beginning of the 20th century, of the first Russian Revolution of 1905, had turned into the mechanical, quote, permanent revolution of the wartime era. Through many years of detailed studies, I have spent much time trying to comprehend the essence of the February Revolution and the Jewish role in it. I came to this conclusion and can now repeat, colon, no, the February Revolution was not something the Jews did to the Russians, but rather it was done by the Russians themselves, he means the February before the October, which I believe I amply demonstrated in The Red Wheel, which I have not read. It's another thick tome. We committed this downfall ourselves. Our anointed czar, the court circles, the hapless high-ranking generals, obtuse administrators, and their enemies, the elite intelligentsia, the Oktoberist Party, the Zemstvo, the cadets, the revolutionary democrats, socialists and revolutionaries, and along with them a bandit element of army reservists distressingly confined to the Petersburg's barracks. And this is precisely why we perished. True, there were already many Jews among the intelligentsia by that time, yet that is in no way a basis to call it a Jewish revolution. So he's saying the Kerensky one was not a Jewish revolution, but obviously the Bolshevik one was. One may classify revolutions by their main animating forces, and then the February Revolution must be seen as a Russian national revolution, or more precisely, a Russian ethnic revolution. Though if one would judge it using the methodology of materialistic sociologists, asking who benefited the most, or benefited most quickly, or the most solidly and in the long term from the revolution, then it could be called otherwise, Jewish, for example. So even if it was a Russian Revolution, it was in the interest of the Jews, the first one. But then again, why not German? After all, Kaiser Wilhelm initially benefited from it. Although the remaining Russian population got nothing but harm and destruction, that doesn't make the revolution, quote, non-Russian, unquote. Jewish society got everything it fought for from the revolution, and the October Revolution was altogether unnecessary for them, except for a small slice of young cutthroat Jews who, with their Russian internationalist brothers, accumulated an explosive charge of hate for the Russian governing class and burst forth to, quote, deepen, unquote, the revolution. On to 199. We're going up to like 203, I think. So how, having understood this, was I to move through March 1917 and then April 1917? Describing the revolution literally hour by hour, I frequently found the many episodes in the sources that had a Jewish theme. Yet would it be right simply to pour all that onto the pages of March 1917? Then that easy and piquant temptation to put all the blame on Jews, on their ideas and actions, to see them as the main reason for these events, would easily skew the book and overcome the readers and divert the research away from the truly main causes of the revolution. And so, in order to avoid the self-deception of the Russians, I persistently and purposely downplayed the Jewish theme in The Red Wheel. Interesting. He admits he downplayed their involvement in The Red Wheel relative to its actual coverage in the press and on the streets in those days. The February Revolution was carried out by Russian hands and Russian foolishness, yet at the same time, its ideology was permeated and dominated by the intransigent hostility to the historical Russian state that ordinary Russians didn't have, but the Jews had. So the Russian intelligentsia, too, had adopted this view. This was discussed in Chapter 11. This intransigent hostility grew especially sharp after the trial of Bylus, and then after, where he was found guilty of ritual murder, and then after the mass expulsion of Jews in 1915. And so this intransigence overcame the moderation. Yet the Executive Committee of Workers and Soldiers' Deputies, which was formed within hours of revolution, appears very different. This Executive Committee was in fact a tough shadow of government, a tough shadow government that deprived the liberal provisional government of any real power, while at the same time criminally refused to accept responsibility for its power openly. By its order number one, the Executive Committee wrested the power from the military and created support for itself in the demoralized garrison of Petrograd. It was precisely this Executive Committee, and not the judiciary, not the timber industrialists, not the bankers, which fast-tracked the country to her doom. The Executive Committee. In the summer of 1917, Joseph Goldenberg, a member of the Executive Committee, explained to the French diplomat Claude Anet, A-N-E-T, quote, "The order number one was not a mistake, it was a necessity. The day we executed the revolution, we realized that if we did not destroy the old army, it would crush the revolution. We had to choose between the army and the revolution, and we did not waver. We chose the latter, and we inflicted, I dare say, a brilliant blow," unquote. So there you have it. The Executive Committee quite purposely destroyed the army in the middle of the war. Mind you, the Dolchstoßl again, the stab in the back legend in Germany. So here it is in Russia. They're willing to sacrifice the war in order to take Jewish communist power. It is legitimate to ask, who were those successful and fatal for Russia leaders of the Executive Committee? Yes, it is legitimate when the actions of such leaders abruptly changed the course of history. And it must be said that the composition of the Executive Committee greatly concerned the public and the newspapers in 1917, during which time many members of the committee concealed themselves behind pseudonyms from the public eye. Who was ruling Russia? No one knew. As it turned out, there were a dozen soldiers who were there just for show and weren't very bright. They were kept out of any real power or decision-making. From the other 30, though, of those who actually wielded power, more than half were Jewish socialists. So there you go. I mean, there it is. Regardless of how he wants to play it. There were also Russians, Caucasians, Latvians, and Poles. Less than a quarter were Russians. The moderate socialist V.B. Stankovich notes, what really struck out in the composition of the committee was the large foreign element, totally out of proportion to their part of the population in Petrograd or the country in general. Stankovich asks, quote, was this the unhealthy scum of Russian society? Or was this the consequence of the sins of the old regime, which, by its actions, violently pushed the foreign element into the leftist parties? Or was that simply the result of free competition? And then there remains an open question, which, who bears more guilt for this, the foreign-born who were there, or the Russians who could have been there but weren't? For a socialist, that might be the case to look for a guilty party, yet wouldn't it be better for all, for us, for you, for them, to avoid sinking into that mad, dirty torrent altogether? And that ends chapter 13. And I'm going to do just a little bit of chapter 14. At the beginning of chapter 14 is called During 1917. At the beginning of April 1917, the provisional government discovered to its surprise that Russian finances, already for some time in quite bad shape, were on the brink of complete collapse. In an attempt to mend the situation and stir enthusiastic patriotism, the government loudly announced the issuance of domestic freedom loan bonds. Rumors about the loan had begun circulating as early as March, and Minister of Finance Tereshenko informed the press that there were already multi-million pledges from bankers to buy bonds, mainly from the Jewish bankers, quote, which is undoubtedly related to the abolition of religious and national restrictions. Indeed, as soon as the loan was officially announced, names of large Jewish subscribers began appearing in the newspapers, so the Jew bankers were supporting the new Jew-controlled state, accompanied by prominent front-page appeals. Jewish citizens, subscribe to the freedom loan. Every Jew must have the freedom loan bonds. In a single subscription drive in Moscow, in a Moscow synagogue, 22 million rubles were collected. During the first 2 days, Jews in Tiflis subscribed to 1.5 million rubles of bonds. Jews in Minsk, half a million in the first week. The Saratov community, 800,000 rubles of bonds. In Kiev, the heirs of Brodsky and Clara Ginsburg each spent 1 million. The Jews abroad came forward as well. Jacob Schiff, 1 million. Rothschild in London, 1 million. In Paris, on the initiative of Baron Ginsburg, Russian Jews participated actively and subscribed to several million worth of bonds. At the same time, the Jewish Committee in Support for Freedom Loan was established and appealed to the public. However, the government was very disappointed with the overall result of the first month of the subscription. For encouragement, the lists of major subscribers who purchased bonds on 25,000 rubles or more were published several times in the beginning of May, in the beginning of June, and in the end of July. The rich who did not subscribe were shamed. What is most striking is not the sheer number of Jewish names on the lists, assimilated Russian Germans with their precarious situation during the Russo-German War were in the second place among the bondholders, but the near absence of the top Russian bourgeoisie, apart from a handful of prominent Moscow entrepreneurs. In politics, left and center parties burgeoned, and many Jews had become politically active. From the very first days after the February Revolution, central newspapers published an enormous number of announcements about private meetings, assemblies, and sessions of various Jewish parties, initially mostly the Bund, but later Poal Zion, Zionists, Social Zionists, Territorialist Zionists, and the Socialist Jewish Workers' Party, SJWP. By March 7th, we already read about an oncoming assembly of the All-Russian Jewish Congress. Finally, the pre-revolutionary idea of Dubov had become widely accepted. However, because of the sharp differences between the Zionists and the Bundists, the Congress did not materialize in 1917, nor did it occur in 1918 either because of the Civil War and the antagonism of Bolshevik authorities. In Petrograd, the Jewish People's Group was reestablished with M. Vinaver at the helm. They were liberals, not socialists. Initially, they hoped to establish an alliance with Jewish socialists. Vinaver, V-I-N-A-V-E-R, declared, quote, "We applaud the boon, the vanguard of the revolutionary movement," close quote. Yet the socialists stubbornly rejected all gestures of rapprochement. We'll end that on page 203, just into chapter 14. So I think we did, what, four or five chapters to start with that led up to roughly 1885 to 1890. And this is resumed in about 1950 and onward. So there's a gap there I'm going to have to find in some other volume, something to fill it in if I can find, maybe another translation or something. Anyway, you're getting up. We're jumping forward right into the Bolshevik Revolution will be basically the rest of the book. And still, we're only 200 out of 760 pages. So we're not even a full third of the way in. This has been recording 9. So if I have to later, if I find the other material or a different translation, I will fit it in. But we'll have to keep the sequence. So this is number 9. You can find it recorded at vnnforum.com, pivel.net, kirkswilltoday.com. I've been Alex Linder reading to you out of Columbus Falco's possibly gapped translation called The Crucifixion of Russia, a new English translation of Alexander Solzhenitsyn's 200 Years Together, A History of the Russians and the Jews. And we see that Jews are very, very active in creating the revolution, even the one before the Bolshevik Revolution, and we're going to hear about the Bolshevik Revolution very, very soon. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back with you again real soon.